gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, you are listening to Broken But Glorious.
Hulk Hogan, Hollywood Hulkster, whatever they call you, I'm coming after you, you coward.
Hello and welcome to Broken But Glorious. I'm Chris Lapp and I'm delighted to be joined by Grapple Arcade's Mark Fox. How are you doing, Stephen, Mark?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So, how's everything going with Grapple Arcade?
Bouncing, yeah, all good, man, all good. I'm sure we'll have a bit of chat as things are going on, but progressing nicely.
Oh, great. So, and we're also delighted to be joined along by Pablo from the Turn Chuckle podcast. How are you doing, Stephen, Pablo?
I'm all right. It's just me and the cat. The cat might... jump in at some point and start purring down the microphone. she likes to get in the way. She's a bit of a camera hog, a bit of a mic hog as well. But yeah, all good.
Oh, brilliant. So we'll talk about Turn Chuckle in a sec, but you both have started a YouTube series based on classic wrestling stickers. Do you want to? How did you guys meet, and where did the idea for the show come from?
Yes, well, have you taken it away, Matt?
Yeah, no worries. Well, we met through a mutual friend, but I think we both might have sort of randomly been aware of each other at different points in the past, but not known each other, just from the circles that we kind of bounce in and stuff.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? I certainly knew about Grapple Arcade, but I wasn't sure about the person behind it.
All right.
It's one of those. Yeah, and we kind of sort of came together, and we were both on a different sort of show a while back, and we're invited on for the fact that we have a massive appreciation for early 90s wrestling, WWF, specifically sort of like 1990 to 1995 key area.
Yeah, it's
slow up back down. it's a bit obsessive. So that's kind of, we got bounced on there. We kind of just sort of took over the entire show, really just chatting about that.
The
host didn't get a word in edgeways.
No, we won't be left tonight, I promise. Although we started already. And then from there, we sort of, you know, just bounced a few ideas off each other, and we thought, well, we've both got really cool collections of interesting things that we don't mind saying to ourselves, some really interesting, unique bits of memorabilia.
Yeah.
And it's a YouTube thing is always the thing I wanted to sort of crack on with Grapple Arcade anyway, because live events are one thing. I wanted to have some more specific online content, whether it was stuff to do with games, reviews, whether it was footage from live events, whether it's looking at merchandise. So I give Pablo a shout, and we said, should we do something? And so... the bond, the idea of hands off the merchandise, as it's known.
Yeah.
and so we're going to be doing the sticker book stuff, but that's just like one element, if you like, of all the different bits that we're going to be looking at, including different memorabilia from years gone by, everything with a bit of a twist on it. We've got loads of really interesting stuff, like loads of sealed boxes of trading cards from the early 90s. So we're going to be doing lots of unboxings and stuff like that, and looking at things that haven't probably been seen before by a lot of people. I hope you don't mind me saying this, Pablo, but you've got one very, very particular piece of merchandise I think a lot of people are going to be interested in. And we've got loads, let's be honest. The mind being, you've got a TV1 Bobby the Brain Heenan Raw jacket.
Wow. Yeah.
When he was a commentator on Raw in 93, and it's just, that's mind-blowing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I love it. I've worn it a few times. Just around the house, you know. But we've done a few of these things now, and we're really starting to gel as it's going on, sort of thing. Because it's all an experiment, really.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we're learning as we're going, sort of thing.
Definitely.
It's a odd concept, really, like the sticker book thing. But it's amazing how quickly you kind of get into it, and you know, then we talk about all the. You know, if we open a pack and there's a Max Moon sticker in it, then, you know, we just give you some interesting Max Moon facts. I swear there are some interesting Max Moon facts.
Most of the Max Moon facts are around that Conan used to be Max, well, it's going to be Max Moon.
Yeah. there's plenty of interesting stuff. I mean, it's like, as Pablo said, we're just bouncing off each other at the moment, and it's going quite well. Really enjoyable, that's the key thing, and it seems to be being received quite well so far. I think we've been quite close to 300 views in the first week, which I'm quite pleased
with.
We're just shy of it. We'll be releasing a massive competition in the next couple of days. Wow. Episode 2 is about to be uploaded in the next couple of days. Huge competition to go alongside it, because it wouldn't be a Grapple Arcade thing unless we try to bribe everybody to watch something. So we're doing competitions and prizes. So yeah, no, it's going to be fun. Lots of really fun stuff linked into that one.
So Pablo, so where did the inspiration for Turn Chuckle come from?
Well, Turn Chuckle is like turnbuckle, but with a chuckle in there. You know, it's a highly original name, which I must get copyright. No one else has got it as well. If you type in on Google, my podcast is the only thing that comes up, so I should copyright it. But
I thought it was a great name when I saw it.
Well, I had another podcast which interviews like actors, authors, musicians, etc. And then I thought, well, there's lots of wrestlers on Facebook, so I thought I'd, you know, get in touch with a few of them, and ones that don't necessarily do a lot of interviews. So, you know, you kind of just be polite and express that you're a fan, etc., and just hope for the best. And I like interviewing people who don't really do a lot of interviews, so like Ahmed Johnson, the fake Razor Ramon, Sam Houston, Dangerous Danny Davis, Todd Pettingle. I mean, these are names that, like, mean a lot to me, and I think they really appreciate that as well. So, yeah, I've been very lucky. I really have.
Were you surprised when you started how approachable wrestlers were for interviews? Because I found that. Because I used to interview footballers, and they were so standoffish, and they're so media-friendly these days.
Well, some of them are like just don't reply, or some of them will take a screenshot of you asking them and going, "Oh, I'm sick of these marks asking me to, you know, to do it."
I don't mind saying out loud. Disco Inferno did that to somebody.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And so yeah, nice on Disco.
So you have to be careful and at least be polite in the message. Yeah. But I understand that, like, a lot of these wrestlers do so many interviews and are probably sick of being asked the same question. So we're trying to have a bit of fun with it. And I do push my luck a little bit. Like, I had a little series with Colin Delaney, who wrestled on the ECW WWE version.
That was one of my favourite storylines of ECW, him coming in every week and getting battered by monsters trying to get a job. That's hilarious.
Well, he's just made some appearances on 205 as well, which has really driven up the podcast listens, which is really good.
Yeah, but I'm surprised they never mentioned he used to be on ECW. I was really disappointed when he seemed to appear, but he didn't seem to say, well, this guy used to be here 12 years ago, whoever it was.
It's pretty crazy. Well, the thing is, when you kind of interview someone like that, he is best friends with Dalton Castle, so then he was nice enough to come on the show. And, so you just kind of, like I say, you push your luck a little bit and see what you can get, and, you know, no hard feelings if people, you know, but at the same time, I interview really, really random names that you wouldn't think of as well. So, you know, like, I dig through the depths of the internet to find some people. So, like, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've listened to a couple of them. I listened to Savio Vega and Duke Jumps the Drowsy, and you do a great job.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
So you interview musicians as well. So what's the major difference between musicians and wrestlers when you come to interview?
Musicians have something to plug.
Yeah.
Wrestlers have something to sell.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, a lot of the wrestlers... And I'm not, you know, this is just the case. They like to relive a lot of those old stories as well and have fun talking about them. And
absolutely.
Be reminded of things that they haven't talked about for years and stuff like that. And with the musicians, I'm lucky because I've worked with some decently well-known musicians. Like, you may not know them, but you know who they've worked with, sort of thing. And, you know, there's a bit of a community, like, sort of, there's a lot of, like, LA-based musicians that I'm kind of friends with, which, I mean, it sounds really pretentious, but they're just...
You go over there, though, don't you? You've done stuff over there, mate, so...
Well, I've been over there once, and we did a gig over there, and but I've worked with, like, a lot of them from home and, you know, collaborated over the internet and stuff like that. It's been okay. It's surprising what you can do from home. This is why I love podcasts as well, because you can do them from home, and you can talk about what you like as well. Yeah. And, you know, it's the best format or medium out there for me.
Yeah, and anyone who listens to your podcast will know that you're a huge fan of the new gen era of WWF. So, what do you love about this era so much?
Really, it's because it's the time that I grew up watching, sort of thing. And a lot of the stuff like merchandise, I didn't even have Sky. You know, I had to rely on videos or friends taping it or get the magazines and stuff like that. And, you know, it would be one of those things that you'd look in the merchandise catalogue and you'd just look at stuff that you'd never be able to buy sort of thing. So, you know, it's kind of just, a lot of it is reliving my youth, but being able to do it on a grander scale because this stuff is kind of available now. And the WWE celebrates its past a lot more now as well by bringing out the classics figures or putting the old characters on the games and stuff like that. So it's like, and you know, you can walk into a store now and buy a Narcissist Lex Luger figure. Like, that's mind-blowing to me. It's just, I haven't grown up, basically. I'm like Peter Pan, but without the magic powers, so, you know.
Well, I don't know, we're still trying to find them.
I don't look as good in green tights, you know.
The next recording of Hands of the Merchandise, you need to wear that little green pointy hat, though.
A lot of the merchandise that came out during that time as well, it's so stupid. Like, you know, there's like, Pogs, WWF Pogs. I defy, and I don't really show off my collection that much, but I defy anyone to have a better WWF Pog collection than I've got. Yeah. But, and it's actually surprising that I have friends with the amount of
Pogs. We're gonna have a Pog special episode.
Wow. mate, we're definitely gonna do that. And you know, Duke the Dumpster Drossy currently sells signed trash can lids. I jumped all over that. I had to have them, you know.
Damn right.
So yeah, no,
it's just real lids he bought from B&Q and just signed them.
So it's the over the top characters. I mean, there were more cartoony, especially 1994 to 1996. But I just love that. I love the presentation of it. I love that each character stood out and had something that, you know, and they were ridiculous, but I like ridiculous. Like, wrestling needs to be a bit more ridiculous sometimes, I think. And have a bit more fun and not take itself so seriously. I do miss that about it, but that's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a huge thanks to you both for joining us this evening. We'll be counting down the top. What are we going to call it? Strange Bedfellows. Odd Tag Teams.
You called it Strange Bedfellows, weren't you? I think I was calling it Oddballs or something. I don't know. Whatever you want, really, man.
Yeah.
So. Oddballs could be taken in many different.
we will be counting down the top 10.
Yeah.
As voted by you, Strange Bedfellows Tag Team WWFE. Tag Team Champions. But first, we need to send our condolences to the friends and family of King John Bundy, who passed away yesterday afternoon at the age of 61.
Yeah, man. That was a bit of an out of the blue one, that. And I think when you hear his name, and then you suddenly think back and you go, oh, man. Like, I think Pablo's probably going to be in a similar situation to me with this one in terms of thoughts about it. But whilst I did appreciate his late 80s kind of run, if you like, with Hogan, especially the cage match. The whole thing about Bundy for me personally, because of the time frame, was his mid 90s run with the corporation, with the Million Dollar Man.
It's a weird thing that, like, I posted today on the Tun Chuckle Instagram that when Bundy came back, there weren't any, because he'd just come back, so there were no videos or anything like that, but there were of his older matches, and I was just like, I need to see some King Kong Bundy matches. And luckily, the older videos were like really cheap, because you could buy them secondhand, like WrestleMania 3, WrestleMania 2, etc. And the WrestleMania 2 match with Hogan, it just, that was like my first exposure to blood. And, when you used to like the new generation with all the lights and the pyro and everything, WrestleMania 2 looks so grimy and underproduced. But, like, I love that. And I love that Elvira was commentating on it. It really did look like a horror movie, like a B horror movie feel to it. And, Bundy, like, those first three WrestleManias, Bundy really made his mark. Like, beating SD Jones in like
27 seconds, I think, was it?
Yeah, they say 9 seconds, but let's face it, come on. And obviously Mania 2, and then Mania 3, squashing a midget. I mean, who doesn't love a bit of swashing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a bit of a fall down the card from World Championship match to comedy midget match the next year.
Comedy tag match.
This is true, but everyone remembers it. You know, I think the thing with Bundy, I mean, I don't really know what happened in 87, but I think he probably got a bit lost in the shuffle amongst all the big men.
Yeah. This is the thing, because when you look at Bundy, he's a large vessel. He's a big lad, but he's not particularly tall. He's quite of an average height, but he's a mass. You know, he's a solid lump. Is our Bundy. So I think you're right, though. I think when a lot of the sort of big, more sort of taller guys came along, he didn't really stand out, if you like, in terms of being King Kong, as in a monster, as such.
Well, everyone has, you know, I mean, people, I think, kind of forget this as well, that everyone has a shelf life in any wrestling company.
Of course.
And it didn't mean that Bundy got terrible or anything like that. It's just there wasn't anything else you could do with him. Like you say, WrestleMania 2, world title match, WrestleMania 3, squashing midgets.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, like it wasn't like he was going to end up back in title matches.
And the thing, once he's been in the Dizzy Heights with Hogan at that time, like, you can't carry on that feud in WWF for another year. Like, somebody else has come along, so there wasn't very much for him to do. But what's interesting is when he came, obviously, back in 90, well, what was it, 94?
94. He left about October 95. So.
Came back in 94, and you've got to remember, obviously, that's post-steroid scandal, where you've got a lot of smaller guys all of a sudden on the cards. Now he does look like a monster again. In comparison to some of his foes, you know, some of the faces at the time.
Did you ever see the vignettes when he came back?
I don't remember them.
I saw there's a great picture of his where it's just I think it's like an artistic sort of picture of his head in one of the magazines with loads of wrestlers, but it is like a mock on the King Kong concept a bit.
He's like squashing buildings with his hands and stuff.
I remember.
WWF. I mean, you know, the Mania 2 is probably his legacy, I would say. You know, main event of WrestleMania.
He was the Undertaker's fourth victim at WrestleMania, WrestleMania 11.
He was.
Fitz von Erich's final opponent.
Sorry, mate?
He was also Fitz von Erich's final opponent in his retirement match in 1982.
He was indeed, back when he had hair.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember when Bundy first came to the WWF, he had a very weird look of sunglasses and like a Dracula cape.
I do remember, yeah.
He didn't keep that for long. Yeah, it wasn't a good look. But
another piece of news, Honky Tonk Man and Tori Wilson have been announced that they'll be in the Hall of Fame this year. Do you think these are both worthy inductees?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm surprised Honky hasn't been in before now, to be honest, but I think that's more to do with politics of him wanting to... You're not allowed to wrestle, was it, on the indie scene for six months or something like that?
Was it 90 days each side or something?
90 days, three months or so?
Yeah.
So that's apparently been one of the reasons why I didn't want to be on it, why it never happened. I think other people are also suggesting that big. He's the kind of character you might not be able to trust on a live broadcast. So that might have something to do with it as well. He's been quite quiet and placid for a little while now. He hasn't been shouting his head off on podcasts for a while.
No.
So now that that's all kind of out of the way, all of his shoot interviews he's done a while ago, he hasn't done any in a long time. People, you know, if you got him in during the days when he was going to be doing, you know, the height of his shoots, when he was talking about drugs, rock and roll and slagging everybody off, then it would have been a bit controversial, I suppose. Whereas Tori Wilson, absolutely, of course she deserves to be in it. Brilliant.
There's a few people complaining that it's a disgrace that she's in before Miss Elizabeth, but...
But Elizabeth, you have to... She has to be... they have to treat that one delicately, I think. I mean, I don't know, I just... It's a really strange one where they've got, like... They have to play the politics between which live inductees they have and which ones
they only seem to like to induct one deceased wrestler a year.
I mean, out of curiosity, have they inducted Bundy? I can't remember.
No,
they had. He's not in the Hall of Fame, is he?
No.
So
which is a crime, now, but like,
it is. He's one of the guys that, you know, you could have easily have seen in there, and it's just a shame that he sent a tweet out, didn't he, literally less than 24 hours before he passed away. In fact, about 10 hours before he passed away, promoting an event he was going to be at where he was tag team with Al Snow, I think it was, or something. And then he passed away a few hours later.
It's quite sad.
It is, it really is. Sorry to go back to that again.
For me, Honky obviously deserves it. Within the longest Intercontinental Champion, probably drew a ton of money, longevity, all that kind of stuff. I think now for me, like, I don't want to diminish the importance of the Hall of Fame because I love it, and when someone I like goes in it, it's great. I think there are people who could go in before Tori Wilson for me, like Leilani Kai, Velvet McIntyre.
Oh, without a doubt.
You know, it shocks me that they haven't been even asked, especially since Leilani Kai is under a Legends contract and stuff like that. But you know,
I think the thing is, though, you've got to understand that. Suppose that names like Leilani Kai have got an impact for people like us, whereas Tori Wilson's the obvious draw, if you like. She's still fresh in people's mind. So I suppose she's almost more of the celebrity wing to an extent. You know what I mean? She's like, she fits that caricature rather than a stalwart 80s awesome wrestler.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I totally agree. They've got to sell tickets on the night.
It's more that than anything else. No offense to Tori Wilson, of course, but you know, she's more of a, is it fair to say, a poster girl, so to speak, for selling tickets because of her celebrity status as such.
Mm. Yeah, for me, though, I mean, there's a few names now, and it's always been the case, but I don't think there's any specific rules to go in the Hall of Fame. I don't think there ever has been. When people like Tori Wilson and, I don't know who else, like James Dudley or whatever, you know, like when they go in, it does seem just like, I don't know, like they've got a list of names and think who can they diversify this year's class with and all that kind of stuff.
We've got to remember, they're ticking quota here as well, aren't they? So it's like, there won't be a list of rules, but there'll be a basic sort of rung of, right, who's the main eventer-esque kind of wrestlers that we're putting through this year, or the headline act, if you like, that we're putting through this year?
Yeah.
Who's the celebrity sort of going to draw the crowd in who might interest the spouses and things like that, dare I say?
Yeah.
To that kind of audience. Let's be honest, who's going to be the sort of the mid-90s filler? Like, that's the way they view it. I see that. And they're the ones I want to see the most. I want to clarify that now. But they're the ones who are sort of added on, if you like. Like your Coco Beware, for example, yeah? They're the ones I want to see the most, but they're not the ones who have been given the phone call first, let's be honest.
You definitely have a headliner than a woman, a tag team, a deceased wrestler.
They've got ones like your classics, like maybe your more NWA legends or your AWA legends and people like that who... There's an abundance of characters, let's be honest, who they could potentially put in, but they're not going to maybe draw the same way that Tori Wilson might to that crowd.
I guess, and that's my thing about the Hall of Fame, though, that, like, I love...
It's a WWF, WWE Hall of Fame, not a wrestling Hall of Fame.
No, I don't get it, but if you watch, like, the 94 to 96 Hall of Fames, and even the 2004 one, it seemed more wrestling fraternity. Based more than
I agree.
Trying to pull in an audience and all that kind of thing, and you know, I don't know, because the thing is, for me, when you get like a large fan audience in, there's always the chance that like there's going to be someone in the crowd that's going to be really disrespectful.
Yeah.
And that's really done it. Like they did it with Gordon Soley, his family. They did it with the Bushwaggers. They did it with like Sherry, just like shouting at. And not everyone could deal with that. Well, Sherry could. She was off her face. Like she was ready to have a fight with anyone that night, which I thought was tremendous. But like Gordon Soley's family, who are like taking this really seriously and trying to pay tribute to their family member and all that, and you have someone in the crowd shouting because the microphone isn't loud enough and stuff, and it's like, I don't know.
It's a funny old thing, the Hall of Fame thing. I do enjoy it because it always feels like it could go drastically wrong at any moment. It always feels like it could be an absolute shambles at any point.
I do kind of like that about it, though. Like, when Bill Watts got put in, I'm like, ooh, give him never mic.
Oh, it's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. Like, and Cornette as well. That was a brave one, putting Cornette in as well. Like, you know what I mean? You can just imagine now that he was held up backstage by his throat and debuted there. No, but anyway.
I have a feeling,
sorry, Chris.
Yeah, this year I have a feeling they'll probably give them time limits after Hillbilly Jim's speech last year.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You know, but I'll leave it at that.
So we are going to be a bit disappointed now. Honky can't be at the Love of Wrestling.
Yes, that's the... I am gutted. I know he's been over here a couple of times. He's done a few meet and greets and stuff. I've personally never met him. I've actually, for the last sort of close to a decade now, not really been to a lot of live big events, if you like. I've been to a lot of local stuff and travelled around to see sort of smaller events. But for the last sort of 8 or 10 years, I haven't been to anything of magnitude. I think the last one I was at was WrestleSlam 2 or 3 or whatever it was. And I haven't been able, I haven't had the opportunity to meet any big names, if you like, mm-hmm. any legend names for a long time. So I'm massively looking forward to this. And it comes with the territory that card's always going to be subject to changes, even at events like this. I'm a bit good. I'm not going to get a chance to meet them. And I'm hoping that the rumours of other people that might be going in,
Christian.
Yeah. I'm hoping that, you know, it's not going to be a similar situation where they can't come. Fingers crossed it won't be.
This is the Monster of Baden, the biggest masked member of the Rejected, and you're listening to Broken but Glorious.
Alright, so tag team wrestling has been a huge part of the sports of Kings for years. The combination of two wrestlers, two superstars, usually have similar goals, looks, background, forming one cohesive unit in an attempt to win the tag team championships. However, WWE sometimes like to throw rather strange bedfellows together, so these are the teams that don't look like each other, they don't have similar backgrounds, they're odd pairings usually sometimes. It's feuding superstars who somehow win championships together. So here is the countdown of our top 10 unlikely odd couple strange bedfellow WWE tag teams. Huge thanks to everyone who voted. This was done over both quick survey and Twitter. It was a combination of both. So this is the final 10. So number 10 is Yokozuna and Owen Hart.
Oh! That's all I'm going to say. That one's top of the matter. I absolutely love this tag team. I can't express from a visual standpoint,
Owen Hart and Yokozuna are drastically opposed of superstars.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I mean, it all came about with the debut was on Mania 11, wasn't it?
I think it was
Yoko's return. He hadn't been in since Survivor Series.
Owen had a mystery partner, and it turned out to be Yokozuna against the
Yoko was taken off TV to lose some weight, and he came back about 70 pounds heavier.
It did. I know it was mad. It was. I know his biggest. It was what 650 or something. He was being billed. He's well over 600. Well, he was being billed at like 650. I'm sure it was something like that.
There's one magazine, a Raw magazine, when Yoko, because Yoko was still under contract through all of '97.
Yeah,
and they were like posting articles on where's Yokozuna and stuff like that, and they say, I don't know if this is true or not, but his last match was Survivor Series 96, and they said that he weighed 800 pounds.
Wow.
No way.
Survivor Series 96. Nah. I don't think that's true. That can't be true. He would have died in the ring right there. Right?
Yeah.
Apparently his dream was to be the biggest wrestler of all time.
Verbally on a show was about 660 or something like that.
Something like
And I think it was, I always remember him around the sort of the, but when he made his debut, I think they were sort of billing him at the sort of 520, 530 mark.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you're talking £100 in the space of a year.
Yeah.
I mean, that's impressive, man. He's basically put my wife on in weight.
Did you say that? Do you remember, was it Legends of Wrestling? He looked enormous on that. Have you ever seen that? It's him.
Or, which one was that? Which one, sorry?
It's him and at the Anvil versus Jake the Snake and King Kong Bundy in the main event.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
And he's absolutely enormous and he can barely walk.
Well, didn't he, like, was it in he was doing something over here, when it, like, and he was in a hotel.
He died in Liverpool,
He died. He saw, apparently the rumour was at the time that what the newspapers were trying to say, you know, the tabloids were, that he saw a spider in his hotel room.
Yeah.
And he had a heart attack off the back of it.
Yeah.
He was wrestling for, I believe, Paige's mum's company at the time as well. Yeah. He did do matches for them with Greg Valentine and a couple of others.
Yeah.
It was 2020. This is grim, and I don't know if I should tell you this. And feel free to cut this out if you don't want people to know. But I came across this by accident. But Yokozuna's open casket picture is on. And it's not fun to look at. He looks like he's rotting away in the thing. It's horrible. Yeah. if you've got kids listening, don't Google that.
No.
The Yoko at Mania 11, like, I remember, because that was around the time when all I saw really were the pay-per-views and the little bit extra things, and Yoko wasn't at Rumble 95, and it was a big shock when he came back, but I loved the subtle comedy of it, that Yoko would destroy them, then Owen Hart would just, like, come in and go for the pin.
Yeah. I loved everything about it. It showed you Yoko's devastating sort of ability, still. It showed you Owen's cocky Owen Hart persona in great volume, because now he's got the big guy to hide behind, you know, that whole kind of, I'm going to get you, sort of stood behind the big guy while shaking his fist kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, it was just a brilliant tag team. And add to the mix, you've got Fuji and Cornette.
Yeah.
just smashing. And they were only together for around about 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just shy of 6 months. And they held the titles,
It was twice, yeah.
The first, I think one of the reigns was over, like, it was nearly 6 months, I think, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much nearly the entirety of the time that they were together.
Yeah. If you go back to Paige's mum's promotion, did you hear what strange bedfellows they're putting together for the next show?
Ryan Giggs and Chris Akabusi. No, I don't know.
Almost. It's Billy Gunn and, do you remember, Grant Holt, the former Norwich striker?
So, a former Norwich striker being Grant Holt and Billy Gunn.
Yeah.
Excellent. Unbelievable. Who's that? Is that Ricky Knight who's booking that?
Ricky Knight's booking it, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. See, you can go all out now that his film's come out. He's just like, right, I'm booking Grant Holt. I'm booking all of his favourite people he's ever come across.
All right, so should we go on to number nine? So, number nine, Steve Austin and Dude Love.
Good choice. The storyline leading up to that, because obviously Michaels got injured, Austin, he didn't want a partner, but he even chose Harvey Whippleman one time,
and
he was like, "You're my partner now." And then, you know, but Mankind came out with the sign saying "Pick me, Steve," because he wanted to be his partner, but he kept getting turned away every week, and then. He comes out one week and he's like, I'm going to do something that I never thought I'd have to do again. And they made a really big serious thing about it. Then the next Dude Love came out. But, it was putting Austin in a very likable situation where he got to show a different side of himself.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Yeah,
there was a bit of comedy for the first time. And
on his face, like a wry smile on his face quite a lot of the time during that.
Yeah,
and I don't think they even defended the titles on TV. Because Austin injured himself not at SummerSlam not long after that. So
Austin and Dude Love captured the titles from Owen Hart and British Bulldog and were forced to vacate the titles 55 days later due to Austin's neck injury. So.
Yeah.
Yes. It is a shame. I don't think it was ever probably designed to be a long-lasting thing. And at the very least, it meant that just by convenience, they had to bring in Cactus Jack to really, you know, give Foley that edge again. And it's one of the greatest roles ever when Cactus Jack returns. But the Austin Dude Love thing is, I mean, there's a great photo shoot where they've both got the belts, dude's wearing it upside down, and Austin's just like, what am I doing? Like, there's some great pictures of it. But 1997 is one of my favourite years, and that just really sums up that year for me.
How they
were just willing to take chances and just throw just random stuff against the wall. And I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a deleted scene from Beyond the Mat where it's backstage with Russo and Vince and all that kind of stuff, building up Dude Love's debut that night. And it's really fascinating for just on anyone gets a chance.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm trying not to ramble.
It's all good.
Number 8 is Matt Hardy in MVP.
Now, this was interesting. We had a chance. Well, I had a chance to sort of have a bit of a chat with MVP before his tour over here.
Yeah.
A couple of months back, or a few months ago now, wasn't it? It was back at the end of last year. And just a lot of the info that was getting passed back and forth was he mentioned a little bit about that at the time, and that he really respected Matt Hardy at the time. And but in, he's a character that I personally believe is hugely underrated, and he still is underappreciated. I think is probably a better word to use, actually. And he's one of those kind of guys that he just oozed the charisma that he had was. It was so natural and it was massive, the charisma that he had. And he was still very talented in the ring, don't get me wrong. Maybe he isn't the kind of guy that springs to mind, though. I think he was unfortunate with when he was there, I think more than anything else. Because it was kind of like, for me personally, they were kind of like the lost years, those years, where I didn't really have as much of an interest. And I think that was the feeling generally across the board. People were everybody was a bit stagnant with it all. But you know, Hardy. He's been been around for a long time. I mean, what was the general opinion of them being Oddfellows as such from other people's point of view?
The story was that Matt Hardy unsuccessfully challenged MVP for the US title, and then MVP started boasting that he's superior to Hardy, so they started doing sport competitions or basketball.
Yeah, I remember all that. Yeah,
and then
they became a tag team at the back of it.
Theodore Long did the Theodore Long thing, was dead. You're in a tag team match, fella.
And
put them in the ring against Juice and Domino. They won the titles. And then...
Juice and Domino, good lord.
They held them for about 6 weeks, I think, and they lost them to John Morrison and The Miz.
And I think, if I'm right, Matt Hardy got injured or something and then returned at WrestleMania 24 and did the Twist of Fate on MVP off the ladder, and that kind of resumed that feud, I guess. I mean, this is not my time period, I've got to say, but funnily enough, the basketball game, they made a double pack of action figures where MVP's wearing his basketball gear, and Matt Hardy's wearing like a tracksuit and a top, and it comes with a basketball.
Wow.
Yeah.
But MVP, they'd made about three or four MVPs at this point, and they looked really good. But for whatever reason, they made this MVP like the shade of like Kamala.
I've seen that figure.
It's so like, I don't know what they were thinking with that, but it's one of those little curio double packs that you never really think of anymore, but it's interesting to look at. But
I love the whole MVP with the basketball thing as well, because there's a really interesting little simple, you know, like the whole Mr. Perfect thing that's back in the day where you throw and then catch the American football. But they obviously only edit the ones in where he was successful. MVP was doing it in front of a live crowd, and there's some snippets of him missing quite a lot with the free throws and stuff like that for the basketball. So there's like him in front of a live crowd missing, and then when he eventually gets it, he has to pass it off as if he got it the first time, and then the crowd are still remembering the fact that he didn't. It's wonderful.
Not many people could wear that ridiculous outfit and get over with it.
I absolutely love him. I really hope there's an opportunity for him to do something else with him in the future.
But there was rumours that he was going to come back when they did the brand split a couple of years ago, because they just needed Carders to fill out the division.
He's such a good guy, man. He's a really nice guy to speak to as well, actually.
Does he work in Mexico now, I think?
Sorry?
Does he work in Mexico now, I think?
He gets about, like, I mean, like, he, he's been an IWGP champion and everything, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's, at one point, I'm sure he was, that, and at one point as well in WE, he was a tag team champion and United States champion at the same time.
He's
had a lot of gold around him. Like he has been. He's regarded wherever he goes to. He's regarded as top quality, top caliber, enough for people to trust him with titles. Mm. And then, but he just I don't know why he just doesn't like sort of hasn't translated properly yet, and it's just shame because he's bloody talented.
Yeah.
Right,
I think before, like, sorry, I'll throw this in. I think that period, that 05-06 period, that they were trying too much to find the next top star, and none of it seemed to work, sort of thing. And almost like they were pushing them too hard for a little bit, like they did it with Kennedy, they did it with Boogie Man. They really tried to push him hard, and just nothing was really catching on for whatever reason. And MVP was, like you say, wrong time for him, you know.
I don't know. When my son goes back and watches that time now, he thinks it's amazing that mid card's up a big card, because it's all people who are like main eventers.
Yes,
you know what? I'm going to make a habit of, because I missed it out because I just had no interest in it.
Yeah.
But I bet there's some absolutely fantastic random weekly episodes of SmackDown and Raw that I haven't even seen before from that time period. And probably ECW as well, to be fair. I remember watching some of it, but then just, you know, it not being ECW, so then just losing a bit of interest. Like everybody, like a lot of people did at the time. And I'm going to make it actually a point to go back and start watching some of that stuff, because I think it's only fair that I do.
Yeah. I don't know. When you had a mid-card of Matt Hardy, MVP, Miz, John Morrison, Chris Masters,
there's a lot of good names. Yeah. It was probably the writing, probably.
Yeah, Carlito was there.
Yeah.
Right, so number 7 was Kane and X-Pac. So this pairing actually lasted a good amount of time together. X-Pac came along offering friendship to the Big Red Machine. Kane had never spoke before. X-Pac got him out of his shell and began speaking with a, I don't know what they call it, the buzzer.
Just like that. You can make someone speak, apparently, just like out of nowhere, you know, in the attitude era.
X-Pac was great for that. I mean,
yeah, the X-Pac, the king of oratory skills, managed to get Kane to speak without using a voice box, you know, like, because.
Like he's basically a therapist, a speech therapist. He's just sold. No, I thoroughly enjoyed this tag team. I really did. I even liked the nonsense stuff that they did with Tori and stuff like that. I thought that was all brilliant, where they used Tori to be Kane's girlfriend, and then X-Pac came along and then stole her. You know, once the team sort of split, and then Tori then became a fully fledged member of DX, showing a wild side, even though she had about as much impact as she did before.
Yeah, she's not being a milk duct of DX, is she?
I absolutely loved this team. I think it was the best for me. I know there's others to come, potentially, but it was the best odd pairing with Kane, in my opinion.
I think it's it was quite a risk, looking back on it now, to add this kind of human dimension to Kane.
Yeah.
But they really did build it up, because if you look at some of the early Kane X-Pac magic, they beat Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett for the tag titles, and it was kind of like they really were thrown together out of convenience, because China had turned on Kane and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And Kane had his heart broken and all that kind of stuff. But the early Kane matches with X-Pac, you'll still choke X-Pac and almost kill him, because he doesn't know what's going on. And they've really built up a really emotional friendship over the course of the next 5 or 6 months. And
they humanized him.
Yeah, but also when Kane got turned on, then the monster came back and he brought back Paul Bearer and all that kind of stuff. And it was like, it's a really forgotten, like, sort of aspect of the Attitude Era, that they really did build upon, like, friendships and touch on emotional elements and stuff like that. Like, there was a bit where X-Pac felt that he was he couldn't survive in the land of the giants and all that kind of stuff, and then Kane didn't want to save him and all that kind of stuff, and then he did, and then X-Pac gave him the big hug. It was good stuff. It was indeed.
I personally think that because they've used that scenario since then multiple times with different people, possibly even a few times before that. It's not coming to my head at the moment. But that was, I think, for me, that's the best human person and a monster type pairing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where they bring the monster out of his shell.
Yeah.
I think that for me is the best version of that kind of a script by far. I think they nailed it between the two of them.
There were so many aspects to it. Like Undertaker was trying to manipulate Kane into joining him and stuff, and X-Pac wasn't having any of it. And you know, you got sympathy behind an unlikely team, but also behind characters that wouldn't necessarily command sympathy. Like X-Pac's meant to be this, you know, attitude sort of, you know. Get in your face, and Kane's this big monster and everything, and just it really was, it had just an extra dimension to it, which I think people should maybe go back and if you look at, like, there was a lot of nonsense going on, but if you look at, like, some of the storyline threads that went throughout 99, that is by far one of the best of it. And I think it's actually a shame when X-Pac turned on Kane.
Definitely.
Because, to be honest, I don't think the feud really lived up to what the tag team was.
Agreed. You know, I don't think they knew what they were going to do with that. I don't think they knew where they were going to go with it. I think they just wanted to split it. Maybe to make Kane, maybe they just needed another big monster heel at the time or something like that, so just pulled the trigger when they did.
Well, the Kane X-Pac thing, I mean, I think that is an indictment of the attitude, that the Kane X-Pac thing should have been a major match at WrestleMania 2000.
Agreed.
But they did it at Survivor Series and Armageddon and No Way Out, and just dragged it through the B shows. Yeah, and then WrestleMania was some tag match with Kane and Rikishi or something against X-Pac and Road Dogg, and it was just like,
completely
flogged
the dead horse.
Yeah, but big fan of that team.
Indeed.
Yeah, so we skim over the next one. Because it's kind of
Braun Strowman
and Nicholas. It honestly doesn't get any more weird than teaming a monster with a literal child.
I don't have any time for this one whatsoever. And people tried to convince me at the time, and I just thought, no, I hate everything about it. I appreciate Nicholas is one of the referee's kids, isn't he?
Yeah, it's John Cohen's
kid. Well, put him back in the crowd. I'm not bothered. Like, it did absolutely nothing for me, and I just thought, You've ruined Braun Strowman. And he's never recovered. He's never recovered fully for me. Like, after that, he really hasn't.
Yeah. And,
like, my head in, for me, personally, obviously. People will disagree.
I really thought that his mystery partner was going to be Hogan, which I would have, like, been over the moon with, but no, it was terrible. Yeah, no one could defend.
They built it for weeks, who's his partner going to be, and it was a child.
Nicholas, I mean, there's, you know, I won't be buying the Nicholas action figure or, you know, playing him on 2K19 or whatever, you know.
He was booked for an indie show, wasn't he?
Was he really?
He was booked for an indie show,
He's undefeated, to be fair, though. I mean, you know, Tatanka can't say that anymore. He's not undefeated anymore.
It's a Strowman and Nicholas.
Well, I hope he's... He hasn't even done his sats, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I say, Strowman and Nicholas were... They were forced to relinquish the title.
Yeah,
Strowman
hasn't done his sats, not bothered.
Number five. So, William Regal and Tajiri.
Yes, a million times. This was an absolutely beautiful pairing of... I personally believe that this should have been number one. That's my honest opinion of this. I'll mention that now. I believe that this was... Just the way they created it was just so typical WWE playing the race card. It was incredible. But they managed to do it with two people at the same time. William Regal sipping tea, besmirching and calling people... He's a bloody ignoramus, is what he is, and stuff. Just his crack as the GM or whatever he was at the time, whatever the role was at the time, was absolutely phenomenal. I think it's the best performance I've seen from an off-screen character. An on-screen character that's not in the ring. Whether they want to call him a GM, what was he, commissioner? Is that what he was?
Commissioner.
I think he's by far the best secondary character, if you like, to an in-ring performer. They've had at least in 20 odd years. He was fantastic. And just bringing Tajiri into the mix as his little sort of weird Japanese manservant-y kind of whatever he was meant to be. I don't know. It was just phenomenal. It just screamed racist Vince.
I love that Tajiri didn't have any vignettes. He just showed up backstage one day and just... There's a story that Regal told on one of his one-man shows where they would make up stuff just to make each other laugh. And there's this bit where Tajiri's pouring Regal tea. And Tajiri, while he's pouring it, he's just making a noise. He's just going as he's pouring tea. And Regal just pisses himself and is like, yeah, we've got to go with that. It was absolute nonsense. I've got to say, I do love Regal and Tajiri, but if I had to say, I do prefer Regal and Eugene.
Yeah. Not for me.
It had more of an emotional story behind it, where Regal was kind of, he had to become like Eugene's carer almost, and he was ashamed of him, and then over time he grew to really, this for me though, should have, because how Evolution took advantage of Eugene, that should have been Regal's push into the main event for me. I think that was the biggest wasted thing about Regal during that time. He got one title match on a Raw, maybe. But, I mean, don't get me wrong, love Regal and Tajiri, but, I mean, Regal's just everything he does.
I think this is the thing, you see. I think that's the key to this thing. I think because any wrestler who was as charismatic, and if you want to put it that way, who's got an evil side to them but funny as well. I mean, we could list a number of different people who fit into that category. And could easily have become that persona for Eugene, if you like, his carer, so to speak, that role. So I think because of that, that's why I probably wouldn't have that in this, because I think the storyline of Eugene and a person being his carer, so to speak, was brilliant in terms of how it panned out. But I believe that, dare I say, a number of different people could have played it, and it still would have been as oddball, if you like, because of what
Okay, I know this is meant to be oddball, but I think Regal just acted it so well, and it brought out more of a serious side to him that hadn't been seen. Like, a serious side is a face, though.
I completely agree. I think it was a great pairing. I just, as an oddball pairing, I don't know. It screamed like a movie, if you know what I mean, like a storyline from a movie where, if that makes sense, where the grumpy old man next door doesn't like the young upstart kid, that kind of thing. Yeah. Whereas with these two, they were both foreigners, I suppose is the best way to use it.
It is.
Land. And you had proper Brit, you know, loves the Queen Regal, and Tajiri, who doesn't speak any English at all, and just like nods his head. And just okay, like just the nonsense that they got involved in. I think it was comedy gold, basically. That's what I love about it.
I do agree. But the one thing that ruined it, as it ruined most things, was the alliance.
You
know, Regal shouldn't have turned for me. Unless you're going to actually start putting them in like main events or something like that.
Yeah, there's no need to otherwise, is there?
And I don't want to start getting into the alliance, but the whole alliance thing.
That's another show.
but with the turns and stuff like that, it just took so much fun out of it.
It did. It was just far too much, and because of how much it impacted on the sort of the mid card, if you like, and the stuff that didn't really need to be changed. It did. But I love that tag team so much. That pairing of Tajiri and Regal, I love it.
Number four, I'm sure these were only a tag team because the names are similar. So the Hurricane and Kane. They had similar names. They both wore masks.
Well, weren't they called Hurricane?
Hurricane
as a tag team.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So they successfully defended their titles against Storm and Christian back in 2002.
I'm not
the cane that was used during this period. I couldn't care less about, to be honest.
I'm surprised this one's higher than the X-Pac one.
Sorry?
I'm surprised this team's higher than the X-Pac.
I think people, if I'm going to be honest, would be voted aesthetically the idea that there's somebody in a superhero costume and another guy like the Devil's Son kind of thing. I think that's maybe the only reason why, where in actual fact, the Kane and X-Pac one was so much more better and oddball than this, because there was a story with it, rather than being thrown together for the sake of it. Nah, it does nothing for me. Kane, during this thing when he was a tag team partner, he was too friendly, he was too facey, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Should we move on to another Kane tag team then?
Yeah.
The one memory, the big memory that I have of that was the TLC match where Hurricane gets injured, so Kane has to defend the tag titles himself.
Yeah.
Against Jericho, Christian, I can't remember who else, Bubba, I think, was in there, and you know, and that was the one where Kane won, and then Triple H came out and then accused him of being a murderer. It was just, I don't know, it didn't do for me, that Hurricane team.
I like both guys as well. Like, I've got to say that I really enjoyed Hurricane's run with Rosie. I thought that was a great tag team, personally. I thought they were brilliant together. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that. It was comedic and funny, and it is what it is.
Hurricane, as the team, was a result of the draft where they were trying to find new positions for everyone.
That's literally it. It was just like, I saw, let's chuck them together. So in that respect, it is an oddball team because there was no thought behind it whatsoever.
No, and they were breaking up a lot of teams as well, putting them on separate shows like the APA and the Dudleys and all that.
The Dudleys one was a heartbreaker for me.
They lasted a couple of weeks and then they moved. Devon back to Road, didn't he? Reverend Devon didn't work.
It's absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
Right, so number three was another Kane team, so Team Hell No. Yeah. Daniel Bryan and Kane.
Kane's had three appearances in this, so it goes to show you that if you're the devil's son, that no matter who they put with you other than The Undertaker, it's going to seem odd.
This is more remembered for their hilarious backstage skits than anything else, I think. So they're...
This is the thing. I thought Daniel Bryan played an absolute blinder during the skits. I thought the skits were incredibly good, because of how good Daniel Bryan is when he's on the mic, basically. And they were really fun. It's just that I think they were probably more impressive to somebody who hadn't seen Kane go through several incarnations of him being a tag team partner with somebody. Yeah. Oddball again, do you know what I mean? So it was fun, but I didn't really see it as a tag team. I saw it more of it was really good to have a couple of three of throwaway skits at the back. Good for what it was, but I don't know.
They held the titles for 245 days. So
was it 245?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'll go straight. I know nothing then.
I think I can understand that at that point. I think around that time I realised they're not marketing to me anymore.
Yeah, you've nailed it, basically. You've nailed it.
It became like sort of like very catchphrase based, and it didn't really have much depth to it. Again, Kane had been through so many character changes. To be honest, when Kane turned, I think he turned on Daniel Bryan, maybe.
Yeah.
When he started wearing the welder's mask for a little bit, he actually became almost like classic Kane again, when he should be feared, sort of thing.
So when he was going after Cena, saying embrace the hate and stuff.
Yeah, and he killed Zack Ryder and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and,
well...
You know, and I don't know, it just... I thought they were trying too hard with the skits, and I think the matches were really good because it's Daniel Bryan and Kane. What Kane showed to me is that he can refresh his character, which is hard to do with really a one-dimensional character.
They lost me with Kane when he started wearing a wig, to be quite honest. Like, seriously, man. I mean, by all means, wear the mask. That screams evil and it's awesome. Like, you know, put the mask back on again after being like sort of, you know, maskless for a while, but then putting fake hair with it as well, man. It just took anything away from it that they could have done with him. It's like, what's he doing? So yeah. he's a monster from hell who's got some issues with follicle growth, and he's a bit self conscious about it. No. But I think I think the main thing for me with this is, no matter how good they were as a pairing, I've just been, as you nailed it there, Pablo, I've been through so much with Kane with his character changes, and he's been part of several oddball tag teams.
Yeah.
Purely for the reason because who he is, rather than it needing to make sense. So that the concept of him being in an oddball tag team had worn off for me a bit by then. The appeal of it had been like, we've done this a few times. You know, give it another month, he'll come back from being a mayor and he'll pair him with somebody else who, I don't know, just didn't work for me. Well, it did work, I just didn't really get that much of a buzz out of it.
Alright, so for number two, we head back to the Attitude Era. So we've got the Rock and Sock Connection, Mankind and the Rock. I didn't realise they'd won it three times, the titles.
God, I guess they did. Well, didn't they lose it to the Hollies or something?
I can't remember.
People forget about that. That the Hollies beat them. Because the thing is, the Rock and Sock thing, like, it started off as a team based on respect and all that kind of thing. But then when things happened, like when there was a lot more depth to it, when Mankind really took to the Rock and did the This Is Your Life, which was like the highest rated Raw segment of all time, and it's the definition of classic attitude.
Yeah.
It went on for like about half an hour. And
just,
you know, but it didn't drag or anything, and it was just brilliant. But like, there was a lot of depth to it when Al Snow became jealous of Mankind and the Rock's friendship, and you know, burned all of Mankind's books and all that kind of stuff. And Val Venus got like the thing about the Rock and Sock connection, apart from being massively, massively entertaining, and one good thing about the Attitude Era for me is that they could incorporate many names in a storyline, and it would make them a bigger star because of it. Like, look at the Ministry and stuff like that. Have, you know, the names that came out of that. And you know, having Val Venus involved, you know, who was kind of floating along at that time, it really pushed him for a little bit. Is like someone who could main event. And you know, the same with Al Snow. Al Snow faced The Rock on Raw once and beat The Rock. You know what I mean? And the Rock and Sock thing, it was fresh, and it was just, it was almost like comic relief, but involving main eventers, which
this is
like,
it's
a very hard thing to do and still have them be taken seriously.
And to do right, and I think the key is with this one as well, for me, more than any of the others on this list, even more so than Austin and Dude Love for me with this particular one. Well, it's in a similar par anyway, is that, you know, Rock and Austin throughout the 90s, after Hogan in the early 90s, Rock and Austin were both bigger than wrestling, if you like. They were both like super main eventers, like more, you know, super duper main eventers, yeah?
Yeah.
So then you add Mankind to the mix, and to do that sort of oddball pairing, if you like, it was bigger than the show, it was bigger than Raw, if you see where I'm going with that. It was bigger than the rest of the show could have been anything. When those two were on there, it was its own thing. It was its own thing, and then the rest of the show. If I'm saying that properly.
And the good thing about them teaming up as well and not being directly in the main event picture is that it opened space up for new stars.
Definitely.
For like the world title picture, like Big Show won the title, and Triple H, and you know, Bulldog was even in the main event title picture for a little bit. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Test got used for a little bit and all that kind of thing. And it was just...
They were literally testing the waters with a few different people to see what was going to work. And I think with The Rock, I don't know. These two just smashed it. Of everybody on here, they got it right the best. I thought, as I mentioned before, Regal and Tajiri, the oddest pairing, more than anything, because of how obscure and nonsensical it all was. There was no story to it. It was just nonsense. And that's why I think it's more odd than anything else, if you're going to use the odd sort of phrasing. And to the point where, you know, Regal, they'd come down to the ring to Tajiri's music, and Regal would come down as his tag team partner, looking to kick somebody's head in, but still to Tajiri's music. It just has me in stitches. The idea of Regal coming down to the ring to Tajiri's music. Whereas with Rock and Mankind, they, out of everybody on this list, they were just superstardom.
And you got to bear in mind as well that Mankind was literally falling apart at this point, and this really did extend his career.
By
5 or 6 months by doing interviews and just having fun and not necessarily having like these five star. Like, I know this is, it's not Rock and Sock, but he said the match when he teamed up with Al Snow to beat the Hollies for the tag titles was the worst match he ever had.
Yeah.
Because he was just so out of shape and he couldn't do anything. His knees were shot and stuff like that. But I think he was just... There becomes a level when you're over to the point where you're just genuinely likable and people don't want to see you get hurt.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like how people felt about Mankind. I think people started to cringe when he was taking chair shots at the end because they were like, oh... I wish he wouldn't do that because I genuinely would have him around for dinner and stuff like that, you know. It added a lot of sympathy to it, and it was perfect when The Rock and Mankind had that pink slip on a pole match because they were forced to. And The Rock won the match, and then Mankind was fired, and then one Raw, all the wrestlers came out, and The Rock, and they went on strike until they brought back Mankind.
Yeah, and it was just like, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
So good. The Rock and Star connection, it earned its place in any bit of history. Like, and it just shows you as well, when they teamed up at WrestleMania 20 against Flair and Batista and Orton.
Yeah.
Like, it was just brilliant. I mean, I'll be honest, Flair was the star of that match, but
yeah,
Mankind and The Rock together, you know, it was great to see again. Like,
I think, you know, in hindsight, they stand above this list, to be honest. they're their own kind of category. But, no.
They're like the Travelling Wilburys of, like, tag teams, aren't they? Yeah. Like, all superstars, you know?
That's it.
Shall we move on to number one, then?
So
number one's probably the most obvious oddball team. So, Booker T and Goldust, who formed an unusual tag team in 2002, but it turned into a heartfelt friendship by the end of it. It started off as hilarious backstage segments, but it turned into a real friendship by the end,
I think they struck gold with these two doing this, because I think that wasn't meant to be a pun either, sorry.
Was it good booking?
We'll draw a T on that one. But basically, I think that with these two, they're so good at what they do, their nonsensical stuff, that they can get away with however poorly, badly written the script is.
Yeah.
So no matter how bad some of the lines that they were given, they can get through it really, really well because of who they are. They're just excellent. They're masters of being able to just come across as hilarity, generally, as far as wrestling comedy goes. And, you know, let's be honest, unless wrestling, like scripted wrestling comedy, isn't always very funny, shock horror.
No. Well, you had Booker dressed as a lumberjack and then Darth Goldust and stuff.
And let's be honest, if you could have got him to do that, if it wasn't these two, you could have done that with, I don't know, a number of different people on the roster. It wouldn't have worked because of these two being able to get it over, if you see what I mean.
Well, again, sorry, go for it.
No, it's all right. I think that they could have easily have fallen victim to really poor, not funny comedy writing with what they were doing here, because a lot of it was on the line. Let's be honest. Some of it shouldn't have been funny, but it was funny because it was Booker T and Goldust who were doing it.
Yeah,
Goldust dressing up as Oprah Winfrey and all that kind of stuff, like, or Steve Irwin and all that. You know, but I mean, like with Hurricane, Goldust and Booker T were kind of a result of the draft, where they had to find places for all these top names that they can't all be in the main event picture. And it was one of those things where I can imagine they were given 30 seconds to just do something, and then it just was great, and then they decided to run with it, sort of thing. They were able to go the separate ways as well and not always be a team, which added longevity to the whole thing. But I think out of maybe all of the teams in this list, because I was still watching it quite full on in 2002, I think out of all the oddball teams, they maybe had the best matches.
That's
also what gave them just the real credibility as well. I mean, the matches against Storm and Christian, or Christian and Jericho, or any of that stuff, like, just... And when they finally won the tag belts, it was quite emotional. Like, Goldust was crying. You could tell that it was just like, you know, it almost seemed like, you know, you're going to personal problems, because he had them since then. But like at that time, it almost felt like his career was saved as well. Mm-hmm. That, like, you know, he worked hard to really get that Goldust character to mean something again, because.
Yeah.
A lot of the characters that came in during the Attitude Era, or especially the New Generation Era, were really dated by that point, and it was just, Goldust had to really adapt, and I don't think anyone can adapt quite as well as Goldust in certain situations. Like,
he can go from he's one of my all-time absolute favourites, Goldust, he truly is. I absolutely, you know, as a kid, I was absolutely mesmerized freaked out, intrigued by everything that he portrayed during his debut.
Turned on?
You know, I wouldn't quite say that, but I was highly like, what the hell is going on here? This is really trippy. Watching the backlot brawl with your mum, and your mum's like, what are you watching? when they got in the ring.
I sent a message to Goldust on Facebook. This is when he wasn't with WWE, so he would reply to messages and stuff.
Yeah.
And I told him that the Hollywood Backlot Brawl is the only time that I could probably watch a 6'6" man get stripped down to lingerie with my parents.
Yeah.
And they'd be actually fine with it, and he liked the comment, and I was just like...
I suppose you go from there, through all the crazy years with Luna, which I thoroughly enjoyed, I don't think many people do. I loved him coming out like in a leash and covered in green and with Madonna bras on and so on. I thought it was incredible.
Yeah.
Losing the plot. I wasn't that into the Bible thumping Dustin Runnels character. Didn't do it for me personally, but that's just me. And then he found his feet with this comedy kind of character, you know what I mean? He did it really, really, really well, because he is legitimately very funny. And what was interesting was, it was the kind of first time we really got to see the comedy Gold Dust, developing to that extent, you know, where it isn't just him dressing up as a weirdo in the ring, it's actually him speaking and being very funny.
Yeah.
But also Booker T as well. We hadn't seen Booker T in any kind of comedic role prior then. So he'd always been a super serious tag team guy in WCW, or he'd come through and he was this guy trying to prove himself. He was arguably the biggest name that was brought over during that initial drafting stage. So you've got this guy who's trying to sort of prove that he's worth his salt when all the fans are sort of like poo-pooing on it a bit because they haven't brought in Sting or Hogan. And like, you've brought Booker T in, and then now he's got to sort of reinvent himself into this character, this funny character. So both guys were unseen to the fans as real comedians, and then they both just smashed it when they were.
I think they were probably given just the artistic...
Bit of free reign,
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure no writer could have came up with, Goldust dressing up as Steve-O. You know what I mean? The bit where Booker T, scores with some woman in a hotel room, and then Goldust is in the bed next to them, and Booker T runs out the room with his underpants down and all that kind of stuff.
And you consider the sort of the writing sort of style of that time frame. If a writer had come up with that, you just know for a fact it would have sank a million ships. Like, it would have been so bad and cringeworthy.
I think they probably did have writers, but I think it was just basic framework, and then you fill in the gaps.
Definitely, definitely.
That kind of thing. But I've got to say, King of the Ring 02, when Goldust is dressed as The Rock, and The Rock is stood there, and Goldust is like, he's got the eyebrow painted on and all that kind of stuff, and he just can't stop rubbing his nipples. The Rock's just like, what are you doing? You're an absolute weirdo. I just love that they kept that pop. Like, there was some kind of... Goldust got some kind of sexual thrill out of, like, dressing as Steve Irwin and Oprah Winfrey. They kept the nugget of the original character there. He had to be weird and off the wall and just eccentric and stuff like that.
Absolutely. But
the comedy was so good. I mean, I'll forgive them for beating Jericho and Christian for the tag belts, since Christian's my favourite wrestler. But, I think it kind of got ruined when Goldust got that electric shock and then he became Tourette's Goldust.
No. Yeah, that was a bit weird.
And the kind of, and then Booker T ended, he entered that horrible storyline with Triple H, which bordered on racism. And that poor match at WrestleMania, which was buried underneath so many good matches. But I think it had a bit of an unceremonious ending, but at the same time I wouldn't have really wanted one to turn on the other. But I think it's well deserved at the top of the list, and for an area that, I mean, obviously a lot of people watch, but I kind of wasn't watching it quite as full on at that time, but they were certainly a highlight of that period for me.
Definitely. So that was our list. So thanks for everyone for voting. So before we go, do you want to promote your social media?
Go for it, Mark.
Cool, man. Well, obviously we've set up our new YouTube show. So the it just is actually Grapple Arcade on YouTube, and you should be able to find us pretty straightforward. Our first video is up there now, where in which we're trying to complete an empty 1992 WWF Merlin sticker book from Slovenia. And we're only allowing ourselves 60 packets of unopened stickers to complete it, which gives us about a surplus of about up to about 90 swaps, roughly. Wow. Give or take. So that's what we're trying to do. That's what the mini series is going to be on. But we've got loads of other bits and bobs, like merchandise stuff, that we're going to be showing as well. The show's called Hands Off the Merchandise. You can find us on Twitter at Grapple Arcade, and I'll be banging on there quite a lot about it. There'll be a massive competition in our pinned tweet as well, so please keep your eyes peeled on that one. And yeah, that's pretty much what we're doing at the moment in terms of Grapple Arcade.
And as you can tell, we talk far too much. But
Lots of editing here required. Yeah. Chris. Yeah.
Can I use the word gobshite? Yeah. you can cut that out if you want. But so Turnchuckle is on Instagram, where I'm kind of I'm posting pictures of like my memorabilia, but adding like cool stories behind them as well. It's not just like a picture with a description, because that didn't really do it for me. But the point of it was to kind of drive people to the podcast, which is, it's all under Pablo's Poppin' Podcast on iTunes, but all the Turnchuckle episodes are in there as well. And like I said, I've been very lucky to interview like various names in wrestling, from Todd Pettengill to Sam Houston to Danny Davis to Ahmed Johnson, Savio Vega. There's more that can't even remember at the moment, but like just very sort of like obscure interviews, but I go very in depth, but also try to have a lot of fun with it as well. And a lot of wrestlers have really enjoyed being on the show, so, like even new wrestlers like Brian Pillman Jr. That was amazing. And Dalton Castle and David Starr, top indie name, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I hope everyone maybe checks it out.
Yeah, all the links will be in the description below the podcast. So I've really enjoyed speaking to you both today. I'd love to have you both on again in the future.
Absolutely, mate, absolutely.
You have to set aside about 3 hours and just let us just ramble for a bit. But like, we do appreciate that you've let us just like kind of invade your show and take over.
We're taking over,
you know, like Stevie Richards in the BWO.
Yeah, we're more BWO than NWO, let's be honest.
What are you saying? I'm not that out of shape.
I can't say that about me, though.
Thank you for having us on.
Appreciate it as always, Chris, man. Lovely speaking to you.